Hello, everybody, and welcome to the New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. I'm John Gazbinian, host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Reza Azir Ibrahimi about his new book, The Emergence of Iranian Nationalism, Race and the Politics of Dislocation. Reza Azir Ibrahimi is senior lecturer at King's College London. That's the equivalent of associate professor here in the United States. Reza Azir Ibrahimi, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me, John, and I'm very pleased to be here.
It's a pleasure. So tell us a bit more about this book, The Emergence of Iranian Nationalism, Race and the Politics of Dislocation. Can you give us a bit of a feeling for sort of what you were hoping to accomplish with this book and what the sort of general argument is?
Right. So the book really focuses on a number of ideas, if you will, or myths of a nationalist character that are very common in among Iranians, both in the country and especially within the diaspora. So if you have ever come across Iranians, these ideas would be very familiar to you. One of them, the first one, is what I call a certain infatuation with the pre-Islamic past of Iran, particularly the Achaemenid past, and a great deal of reverence for Cyrus the Great, the founder of the said Achaemenid past. And this pre-Islamic...
And just to clarify, just to clarify for listeners who may not be familiar with that term, the Achaemenid, of course, the first of the great Persian dynasties of the Persian Empire, right? Sort of 6th century BC.
Yes, exactly. And this period is really considered as the golden age of the nation's history and also the age where its essence essentially was formed. So its stage of purity, if you will. This is the first idea. The second idea is what I dare call a very profound dislike of Arabs as a people, and a great deal of hostility towards anything that is associated quite arbitrarily sometimes with Arabs or Arabness. So that includes Arabic loanwords used in Persian. As you know, 40% of the language is made of words that are common rather than words of Arabic origin. A majority of them are of Arabic origin. And of course, Islam and a number of other practices, if you will. And thirdly, there is this very lively discourse of the Aryan race, which is really at the heart of Iranian identity politics and has been throughout the 20th century, as much in the official discourse of the Pahlavi state than in the if you're in the development of national identity as developed by intellectuals and particularly nationalist intellectuals. It is an idea that is still lively today, so it has survived the 1979 revolution. So this is a cluster of ideas which at some point in my life I came to question. Initially, I would subscribe to them because I grew up in a social environment that very much upheld these ideas. As I grew up in Iran in the 1980s, I'm not referring to my family particularly, who are generally not very interested in these issues, but the extended social environment in which I grew up. However, gradually, when I with some historical baggage, if you will, under my or baggage of historical knowledge. Under my belt, I came to realize the extent of the modernity of the nation state and the modernity of racial discourses and racial thought generally. And so this and my mixed background in the sense of my mixed upbringing, because I partly grew up in Switzerland, and some knowledge of Arabs. I mean, sufficient knowledge of Arab individuals and Arab countries to, you know, to question some of the myths about Arabs. Anyway, all of this put a certain distance between me and these ideas. So I came to a point whereby I could start to gradually question these myths and wonder when and how they came about. And this led to my doctoral dissertation at the University of Oxford under the supervision of Professor Homa Khatouzian, and where I tried to do exactly that. So, you know, trace the origins of these ideas, try to understand who uttered them for the first time, what were the templates that were used, and most importantly, what were the strategies that were pursued in developing this these ideas. And these ideas, I came to refer to them as part of what I call dislocative nationalism. So what do I mean by dislocative nationalism? So I like to point out generally that I don't use dislocation in the sense of geographic dislocation. You know, so for instance, colleagues in migration studies or geography use the concept of dislocation to refer to the experience of migrants, particularly. My dislocation, the dislocation that I focus on, is an imaginary operation. It takes place in the realm of the imagination, whereby, thanks to the theory of the Aryan race, Iran is dislodged from its empirical reality. Its empirical reality being, a land with a diverse population finding itself in the Middle East and largely Islamic. So I'm not claiming that Iran is essentially or fundamentally Islamic. What I am claiming is that when you argue that Iran and Islam are completely dissociated and have nothing to do with each other, this is something that needs to be problematized in view of the fact that, you know, Iran and Islam have something to do with each other. I mean, it's a very basic premise that I use to question this. So this is pretty much the a summary or an overview of the genesis of this book.
Sure. Yes, and it's, I think, a very important and interesting perspective that you're taking. I think all of us who have grown up in sort of Iranian backgrounds in the 20th century have in some ways internalized or absorbed some of these ideas, right? I mean, this sort of psychological dislocation that you're talking about, this idea that somehow this is a nation separate from its surroundings. So I think it's very interesting to see someone kind of grappling with these ideas. I wonder if you can kind of break some of this down for us a little bit more now, sort of take us through the book a little bit. So you talk about this idea of dislocative nationalism, right? This kind of psychological dislocation that Iranians so often seem to like to posit. You begin with sort of, as you would at the beginning, right? Sort of where does this all of this come from? And your first sort of opening chapter is called The Paleontology of Iranian Nationalism. Which basically locates the origins of this dislocative nationalism in what you describe as a traumatic encounter with Europe in the 19th century. Can you tell us a bit more about that and sort of why you feel this phenomenon begins there?
Yeah, so there are several arguments in this first chapter. One is that, so, you know, in terms of nationalism theory, I am a modernist, but I like to believe that I'm a moderate modernist, and so for those of you who are acquainted with nationalism theory, I'm somewhere between Benedict Anderson and Anthony Smith. Many would think that the two positions are not conciliable, but I actually see a conciliation that is possible. So my belief is that there is a pre-modern idea of Iran, which can be traced, to pre-Islamic times. There have been territorial states that bore the name of Iran, particularly the Sasanian state, which was the last state before the advent of Islam to Iran. But my claim is that this idea throughout the pre-modern age is very fluid and is flexible. It refers to a range of ideas of territory and geography and culture and also a state or a number of bureaucratic practices, but it's fluid. It's shifting constantly. And the reason for this shift is that the idea of Iran has not been frozen by a nationalist ideology. That's the difference. So the idea is there. There is an ethne in the sense of Anthony Smith, so a repository of memories. There is a language, there are practices, and there is a vague idea of Iran. But it is very far from being what it is today. This idea has been extensively engineered by the nationalist authors that I discuss. And therefore, the modern idea of the Iranian nation is completely different from what this ethne used to be. Moreover, there are other geocultural ideas that compete with Iran throughout the pre-modern period. And I like to refer to Khorasan often, or Araghe Ajam, for instance. So these are also geocultural ideas, and they occur in numerous sources, sometimes more often than Iran. So then the question is, what happens? What happens for this sort of like vague and flexible and shifting ideas of Iran to become what it is today, which is a very clear idea of a modern nation state? So there is a traumatic encounter with Europe, primarily a very traumatic series of defeats in the hands of the Russian Empire. The Russian Empire in the early 19th century is very aggressively expanding southwards, which brings it into conflict with the Qajar state. Rudy Matej, my colleague from Delaware University, has done very interesting research on pre-modern perceptions of Russians among the Iranian elite. And you realize the extent to which the Iranian elite in the 16th, 17th, 18th century despised, I hate to say, the Russians that were seen as uncouth and bibulous, etc. And here we are in the early 19th century. The Russians are standing at the borders of the empire with a modern standing army, which, as we advance into the 19th century, comes gradually to be seen as impregnable. And impregnable by the tribal forces of the Qajar state. And the defeats that were inflicted on the Qajar state and the large territories that were annexed by Russia bring about a very painful process of self-questioning. So these people, the Qajar elite, had very high ideas about of themselves. They thought very highly of themselves, and they could not understand why the modern Russian army could defeat them. And it was a wake-up call, if you will. They were dragged out of their self-contented torpor.
Is it similar to the victory of Napoleon?
So, it's a long history, right? The encounter of Middle Easterners, or what today we refer to as Middle Easterners, with European imperialism. It happened in very different ways. Overall, there is a schema that is common across the board, in the sense that there is first a sense, and this is very prominent in the Ottoman Empire as well, a very strong sense of military deficiency. Europe is, before everything else in this period, at the first moment of encounter, a very powerful military challenge that needs to be met. And so the first programs of what you could call modernization that are devised in this period by the Ottomans, to some extent by the Egyptians as well earlier, but by the Qajar state in the early 19th century, are programs of military modernization. And what happens is that the subjects of the Qajar state, well, the elites, in fact, of the Qajar state, start, over time to acquire a much better idea of what explains the strength of a modern army with a central command, etc. In other terms, they start to have a better idea or a more precise interpretation of what European modernity is. And these people become what we refer to as the Iranian modernists. So these are people that will devise programs of reform to reform the state in order to meet the challenge of European imperialism, as exemplified by first the Russian Empire, but later in the 19th century also by the British Empire, which defeats Iranian tribal forces at Herat in today's Afghanistan. So what I'm trying to get at is that you have, in the 19th century, this modernist movement. And I always emphasize that this modernist movement needs to be seen as a pragmatic intellectual movement. These people want to reform the state primarily, and they meet in their circles and they devise programs of reform. Programs of reform that will lead ultimately in the early 20th century to the constitutional revolution. However, in the 19th century, so if you are sitting in Tehran in the 1860s and you look around you, you will tend to believe that the modernist movement has so far failed to bring about any change in how the state functions. And Iran has continued throughout the previous decades to be defeated on the battlefield. So there is a sense of disillusionment with modernism, which leads one intellectual, Fatali, Mirza Fatali Akhundzadeh, also called Akhundov in Soviet sources, I mean Russian and Soviet sources, to devise a new ideology, which is very different, and it's dislocative nationalism. So the origins of dislocative nationalism go back to a fatigue with modernism. And Akhundzadeh, who is at the time lives in the Russian Empire at Tbilisi, which is the seat of the viceroyalty of the Russian Empire in the Caucasus, and he serves as the translator of the viceroy of Russia throughout his for more than 30 years throughout his career. So throughout his career, he served the Russian state, but he's looking at Iran, which he considers as his homeland, from afar, sheltered from the censorship of the Qajar state and the ulama or the clergy. And he comes up with the ideas that I referred at the very beginning of this interview, the pre-Islamic golden age, the scapegoating of Arabs for Iran's shortcomings. So he devises these ideas pretty much exactly as they are still formulated today. So, in more than 160 years, this ideology has been extremely stable, which is only testimony to its success in addressing some of the perhaps the psychological needs of those that subscribe to it. Just to finish on how this all happened, the ideas themselves, or some of the crypto ideas, the initial iterations and formulations that will be used to as the building blocks of dislocative nationalism, are to be found in European scholarship on the Orient. It's European Orientalists primarily that considered the pre-Islamic past as better than what came later, because of their profound hostility towards Islam, which you can see across the board with a few exceptions. The idea of the Aryan race opposed to the Semitic race, the Aryan race of which the Iranians in this discourse become the representatives, and the Semitic race of which the Arabs become the representative. This idea of the opposition between the two is a European idea that emerges in in comparative philology first, and then in racial thought, and then that you find traces of in Orientalism. So what Akhundzadeh does is that he takes some of these ideas, but he doesn't sort of like adopt them wholesale. He hybridizes them. He selects some ideas, distorts some of them, leaves other ideas out. He really, you know, he's like a cook in his kitchen. He takes various ingredients that he mixes up, and the end result is dislocative nationalism. So here I tend to differ a little bit from Mostafa Vaziri, for whom I have a great deal of respect, who was the first in the 1990s to analyze the nationalist discourse in Iran. He seems to suggest that the modern idea of Iran is entirely an invention of the Orientalists. And so what I believe he misses out on is this process of hybridization, which is very, very complex, and which Akhundzadeh launches. And just to finish on that note, there's a second thinker who is very important. So, you know, the ideas of Akhundzadeh live under the skin of the Iranian intelligentsia. They don't immediately catch on, if you will. And they might have sunk into oblivion if it wasn't for Mirza Agha Khan Kermani, who 30 years later in the 1890s not only retrieves them and pretty much paraphrases them largely, but he does two important things. One is to add a much stronger racial element to the discourse, because Kermani is far more aware of modern European racial thought. He's the first to use the term Aryan race in any Persian, in any source in Persian, and he transliterates it from French. He seems very well aware of some social Darwinist ideas. So he strengthens the racial element in dislocative nationalism. And the second important thing that he does is to disseminate the ideas of Akhundzadeh. So this is where we stand at the end of the 19th century.
Yeah, and you have these two figures, Akhundzadeh and Kermani, that I think outlined very nicely. Kermani, in particular, has some remarkably colorful attitudes, shall we say, towards Arabs, right? Some really hatred. I mean, there's no other way to describe it, right? You have some incredible quotes in your book. I mean, can you give us a bit of a flavor for sort of some of the things that were beginning to be said about Arabs now, particularly in the hands of Kermani at this point?
Yeah, so I don't have the quotations before. But yeah, he calls them bare ass, vagabonds, he spits on them, etc. And you have, I mean, such passages, you know, go on for pages and pages. The hostility and the hatred is very, 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 very deep and very strong. The reason is that, you know, for these thinkers, the dilemma of Iran in the 19th century is its backwardness. What they referred to as backwardness vis-a-vis European states, vis-a-vis, you know, the British and the Russians, that are the two states that Iranians are most familiar with in the 19th century. And the way they explain that for themselves is by scapegoating the Arabs. So the Arabs become the scapegoats that are to be blamed for pretty much all of Iranian shortcomings. I mean, Kermani states it, and I quote him in my book, says very clearly, says any Iranian shortcoming can be traced to the legacy of the Arabs. And I do take...
And we hear so much of this even still today, don't we?
Absolutely.
I mean, these are such familiar themes to anyone who's listened to any conversations with Iranians at any point.
Yes. So there were first, after the revolution, towards the late 80s and early 90s, you start to have the emergence of this discourse, this secular oppositional discourse to the Islamic Republic, which sees the advent of the Islamic Republic as, again, something that can be traced to the Arabs or to the advent of Islam to Iran. You know, it's very common to hear that the clerics that run the Islamic Republic are Arabzadeh, or of Arab descent, and that they are continuing, you know, the Arabs' atemporal project of trying to stamp out Iran's separate identity. And today, with the quasi-Cold War between Iran and Saudi Arabia. This ideology has given this ideology a new lease of life. So, you know, the opposition between some Arab states and Iran is not seen in terms of the geopolitics of the region today. They are seen as some sort of like atemporal racial hostility of the two people, completely reified throughout history. And today's proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran being just the last manifestation of it.
Yeah. So before we get too far ahead of ourselves, though, I do want to break that, because you break this down very nicely. You know, what this dislocative nationalism, the forms that it begins to take after Akhundzadeh and Kermani, and sort of how it gets developed in the early 20th century. And you describe basically three features of dislocative nationalism, which you gestured towards at the beginning of our conversation as well. Broadly speaking, a sort of glorification of anything pre-Islamic, right? First of all. Secondly, a real hatred, an intense hatred of Arabs and kind of Arab influence that's seen as a form of pollution, really of the sort of pure Iranian soul. And then thirdly, an importing of European kind of racialized ideas, which, you know, you say are hybridized correctly, but, you know, attempts to emulate Europe, a belief that Iran is somehow a European country, sort of dislocated, etc. So I'd like to just go through each of these in turn, if we can. I mean, so you have in chapter three, you call it pre-Islamic Iran and archaistic frenzy. Can you tell us a bit more about this archaistic frenzy for sort of pre-Islamic Iran in the early 20th century?
So if you go back to the foundational texts of Akhundzadeh or Kermani, the representation of pre-Islamic Iran there is one of a utopian society. It's a Garden of Eden of sorts, which is devoid of any of the ills of modern life. There is no poverty, there is no corruption, there is no injustice. It is pretty much a sort of epiphany of the Garden of Eden, with kings that are benevolent and so on and so forth. This pre-Islamic Iran is contrasted with contemporary Iran, which is seen as entirely despotic and superstitious and cruel as a society. What I point out is that the veneration of the pre-Islamic past is not established before the texts of at least not in texts in Persian before Akhundzadeh. The Shahnameh literature has been referred to, but I discussed that at length in my book. I think that the Shahnameh literature has been very much distorted, sometimes out of recognition, to support dislocative nationalist claims. You have examples in Zoroastrian texts occasionally. In Zoroastrian texts certainly, but in other texts as well, some longing for this period. But generally, before Akhundzadeh, the idea that this period was a period of national purity and perfection, which comes to an end as a result of Islam, leading to an altogether negative experience of Islamic Iran, is very modern. And I tried to find the traces of the first traces of this, and it brought me, of course, to Orientalism and other European scholarship. So I think there are two elements here in European scholarship that are important in explaining the place of the pre-Islamic Iran in this literature. One is what I already referred to earlier, is a distaste for Islam, and an infatuation with Zoroastrianism, simply because Zoroastrianism is perceived as something that was there before Islam and supplanted by Islam. Therefore, it must have been good. It doesn't go beyond that. So Montesquieu already in the 18th century, but also Voltaire and Diderot, have very positive ideas about, are very well disposed towards Zoroastrianism. But they know next to nothing about it. And in fact, when the Avesta, the collection of Zoroastrian sacred texts, is translated for the first time in French in a European language by Anquetil Duperron in the 1760s, they react very negatively to this Avesta because it doesn't quite fit into what they imagined Zoroastrianism to be. So this is one element. There is already a infatuation with Zoroastrianism and all things pre-Islamic in European texts, even before the 19th century. And then there is a projection of the frames of thought of humanist classicism onto Iran. So what do I mean by that? I mean that most Orientalists in the 18th and 19th century were classicists. Okay, so they were Latinists, or they worked on ancient Greece, and then they came to Persia, if you will, in a scholarly sense, through ancient Rome and ancient Greece and antiquity. So in the classical humanist reading that you can find, for instance, in Edward Gibbon's The Fall of the Roman Empire, antiquity is the age of science and great achievements, right? And then it's followed by the Dark Ages, which is, as Gibbon used to refer to it, the triumph of barbarism and religion. So you have a non-religious past that was amazing, and then religion comes and destroys it and inhibits, scientific advancement. And this is this reading of European history is projected uncritically onto Iran. And so that explains the belief that the pre-Islamic period was witness to all sorts of scientific advancements, and that the Islamic period was altogether like the Dark Ages of Europe. Something that completely runs in the face of the facts of history that were already available in the 18th and 19th century. So, all the scientific findings of inhabitants of the Iranian plateau that were passed down were those by Muslim scholars. And if we name three of them, I always like to name Khwarazmi, to whom we owe the words algebra and algorithm, a term that is very en vogue today. Razi, which was recently referred to as the greatest clinician of all times. And Avicenna, whose canon of medicine was taught in European universities well into the 17th century. So the second aspect of Golden Age archaism or this penchant for the pre-Islamic past is a projection of a typical humanist classicist reading of European history onto Iran, which was then adopted by dislocative nationalists, because it allowed them to elevate the past of Iran to the level of Europe. It was a very flexible palimpsest because knowledge was very sparse on the pre-Islamic past at the time. You could make whatever you wanted out of it. So they turned it into this highly progressive, advanced society, which is really our essence, which then comes to an end with Islam.
Right. And then related to this, so the second feature of this is this intense hatred of all things Arab, basically. And then you have this wonderfully titled chapter called Of Lizard Eaters and Invasions, The Import of European Racial Thought. And you describe, and you have this wonderful line, if you don't mind, I'll just read here. You say that the figure of the Arab serves a purpose similar to that of a voodoo doll. By cursing it, the nationalist imagination relieves the pain of Iran's decline into backwardness. Can you tell us a bit more about this kind of, how this sort of hatred of all things Arab and Semitic sort of plays into all of this sort of second feature of dislocative nationalism?
Yes, so there are several things. This wonderful pre-Islamic past, which is pretty much a paradise. It begs the question, what happens? So why is Iran today so despotic and cruel and superstitious? And so the answer that is provided is simple, and I think that's why it's so attractive and it's comfortable as well, because it lays the blame on the doorstep of an other, the other of dislocative nationalism, which is the Arabs. So the moment of the advent of Islam to Iran, I mean, I shouldn't even call it a moment because it was a very gradual process. But in the dislocative nationalist mind, it's a moment. And it's not only a moment, it's a teleological moment. It's a moment that makes sense of anything that precedes it and anything that follows it. It's a rupture in Iranian history. It is a moment, and you cannot make sense of that narrative if you don't understand European racial thought, because it is applied to this moment. So what happens is that previously you have a pure race, a pure civilization, Aryan, pre-Islamic Iran. And the what is referred to in dislocative nationalist literature as the Arab invasion is in fact the penetration of this purity by Semites, by Semitic filth, as it used to be called in the 19th century. So you have here a case of racial mixing, which dislocative nationalists, concerned as they are with ideas, 19th century European ideas of racial purity, cannot reconcile themselves with. If their contempt for the Islamic period of Iranian history is not due to the fact that this period has fewer achievements to boast about, or that, you know, had fewer states that are as expansive as earlier. No, it's simply because in their minds, a case of interracial mixing. It represents a case of interracial mixing. So again, if you go back to the European templates of these ideas, this is a very, very prominent idea in 19th century European racial thought. I think the best representative of it is Arthur de Gobineau, who was not a scholar himself, but he was quite influential, let's put it this way, and very influential as far as narratives of Iranian history are concerned, because he was very interested in Iran. He lived there for 3 years as French ambassador to the Qajar state in the 1850s and wrote extensively about Iran. Gobineau believed that only a pure race, I'm simplifying Gobineau's thought here for our purpose, it's a bit more complex than that, but essentially, you know, only a pure race can produce a great civilization. When races are mixed, it leads to degeneration, right? So the moment, so Islamic Iran is a degenerated Iran because it has been mixed with Semitic culture, Semitic practices. And this explains why what is referred to as the Arab invasion is seen in dislocative nationalist literature down to this day, down to this very day as we are speaking, as not a military event. It is not, it's not about religion even. It's not about a empire which aims to expand its tax base, which is the model of most empires, practically all of them, in human history. You know, empires expand in order to tax more people, in order to put more money into their coffers, and then expand more. No, here it's entirely cultural. There is this reified Arab other, which invades a reified us, Iranians, not to tax us or anything, but because they are inherently hateful of us. They inherently want to destroy our separate language, etc. This is why Arabic loanwords are seen as the success of the Arabs. This is why dislocative nationalism, ever since the 1860s, has advocated the elimination of Arabic loanwords in the Persian language. Something that has been attempted in some historical junctures, but with very muted results in the 20th century. This is the reason why this hatred of Arabs is so deeply entrenched in dislocative nationalism. I'm just going to give you one historical example, one quotation. So in the early Pahlavi state, you have a chap called Siyasi, Ali Akbar Siyasi, I think. I'm blanking on his first name. He was a statesman. He was an early Pahlavi statesman in the late 1920s, early 1930s. And he was also rector of the University of Tehran for a while. This chap wrote a PhD at the University of La Sorbonne in Paris. And his dissertation was about how to modernize Iran. And I have to read the last sentence of this PhD thesis when he says, quote, in order to modernize Iran, one must clear up the Persian soul from this impurity. This impurity is, of course, a reference to what he believes is the legacy of Arabs, which is pretty much everything from the way Iranians talk to the way Iranians speak to their religious practices. So clear up the Persian soul from this impurity and allow it to shine from the sparkle peculiar to the Aryan genius. This is very important because it shows that the program of dislocative nationalism is very different from that of the modernists. The modernists actually wanted to reform the state. Dislocative nationalists don't have much to say about the state. Their program of reform hardly goes beyond the elimination of Arabic loanwords and the elimination of Islam. Because in their beliefs, if Iranians are returned to their racial purity, then bam, overnight, Iran will become a great nation again. And this is really what differentiates this thought from modernism. I mentioned earlier that modernism was pragmatic. Dislocative nationalism is not pragmatic, it's historicist. All he does is to provide this narrative, which is very convenient, very comfortable. You know, we were a great nation, so we are inherently great, but then, you know, the Arabs came, it's their fault, etc. This narrative that you find time and again, including in today's Iran, to explain history.
And then the third dimension to this, of course, is the European dimension. You have this chapter called Europe, That Feared Yet Admired Idol. This, you know, it's a series of beliefs, you know, this belief that Iran is somehow a European country that's just been kind of misplaced. These attempts to emulate Europe, this importing of European kind of racialized ideas. Can you tell us a bit more about that as well?
Yes, so I believe that dislocative nationalism is very unique in many ways. Of course, it displays a lot of similarities with other nationalisms. But what primarily differentiates it with the nationalism of Iran's neighbors, be it Indian nationalism or Arab nationalism, is the fact that it was not born out of an anti-colonial struggle. Because Iran was never formally colonized, although there was a great deal of imperial interference in Iranian affairs. And as I mentioned earlier, the first utterances of dislocative nationalist ideas, in the case of Akhundzadeh, came from someone who was serving an imperial state that had gone to war with Iran. His first boss was no other than Paskevich. Paskevich is the chap who signed a humiliating treaty with Iran, stripping Iran of large chunks of the Caucasus. So he has no problem, in fact, with European modernity. If anything, he believes that Iran must become completely, fully Europeanized in order to go back to its Aryan roots. See, this is what's interesting about it. And my claim here is that dislocative nationalism, because of its ideological content, was doomed, if you will, to repress the rights of Iranians. In other terms, that dislocative nationalism can possibly not, or the dislocative project can possibly not fit into a, say, democratic or semi-democratic state that would even remotely respect the civil rights of its citizens. And the reason is the following. Dislocative nationalism has identified practically all the religious, linguistic cultural and practices of Iranians as the remnants of the racial other, the Arabs. And so they have singled out all these religious, linguistic, and cultural practices for elimination. How can you repress the religious, linguistic, cultural, and practices of the inhabitants of a land while at the same time respecting their rights? It's a contradiction in terms. And that, for me, explains a number of early Pahlavi practices, such as the ban on the external manifestations of Shia Islam, for instance, for a few years. You know, everything that you associate with Shia Islam, the commemoration of Imam Hussein, the Taziyeh passion play, the Muharram chest beating, all of these things were banned. All of these things were banned. Women were forcibly unveiled, violently unveiled, I should perhaps stress, in the sense that if women between 1936 and 1941, veiled women were forcibly unveiled on the streets by the police, and their veils were often in public torn apart, torn off, and they would also be hurled insults at and sometimes imprisoned. And these rather authoritarian and even despotic policies that came down from the king in the form of decrees cannot be fully explained if you don't understand dislocative nationalism and the program of return to pre-Islamic Iran that dislocative nationalism devises. Dislocative nationalism believes that if you force them to unveil, if you force them to wear European suits and wear Pahlavi hats, if you don't allow them to practice Islam, and if you replace the Arabic loan words in their language by made up new words or ancient Persian words or et cetera, then all of a sudden, bam, the country will go back to its former grandeur and glory.
And then you have this discussion of Aryanism and dislocation, where you talk about the spread of kind of Aryanist ideology in Iran. I mean, I think we've already touched a fair amount on this, but if there's, I mean, what else, can you sort of say a bit more about that? I mean, sort of how this begins to develop in the 1920s and 30s.
Yes, absolutely. So we've said a great deal about it already. So I will just say that. Then again, this is an idea that emerges in European scholarship, the discovery of the Indo-European family of languages in the 18th century, which then in the 19th century becomes confused with become racialized. So the speakers of the Indo-European languages come to be seen as the members of a race that comes to be referred to as the Aryan race, and similarly, the speakers of Semitic languages. Mainly in the European imagination, their internal others, the Jews, and their external others, the Arabs, and by extension the Muslims, come to be seen as the Semites, the Semitic other. This idea is adopted and then adapted by dislocative nationalists for many reasons. The first is that, you know, it's very flattering. So, you know, you are struggling, or the modernists in the 19th century are struggling with European power and how can we catch up with them. And then you have a few, you know, European scholars that come and shake your hands and they tell you, hey, by the way, you know, you're a member of the same race as us. So obviously, exactly. And so this was very flattering. And Akhundzadeh, and particularly Kermani, fell under the spell of this idea, which allowed them not only to salvage the honor of pre-Islamic Iran, but also to some extent to appropriate the achievements of modern Europe as somehow ours. And here I have to emphasize that this idea is hybridized because none of the racial thinkers, the European racial thinkers of the 19th century, none of the prominent ones, certainly not Gobineau, certainly not Ernest Renan, and others, ever considered Iranians as fully fledged Aryans. If anything, Iranians were a debased variety, in Gobineau's words, under heavy Semitic influence, and there was nothing to do to salvage them. If Gobineau was alive in the 1920s, he would have thought that the policies of the Pahlavi state were a waste of time, that Iran cannot be returned to its racial purity. It's too late in many ways. Iran is doomed. So this is one aspect of European Aryanist thought that dislocative nationalists consciously decided to sweep under the rug, obviously. And then Aryanism plays a very important role in dislocative nationalism, because that idea of dislocation, dislodging Iran from its reality in the Middle East and presenting it as some lost member of the European nations, this only becomes possible with the help of the Aryan race hypothesis. Only when you start to see Iran as an Aryan nation can you make that claim. And then you can go on, as Mohammad Reza Shah, the last Shah of Iran, Pahlavi once said, then you can go on and claim that Iran's situation, location in the Middle East, is a mere accident of geography. So this fascinating process of dislocation, which is factually very obviously problematic and entirely imaginary, is only possible thanks to the Aryan race hypothesis. Hence the importance, the centrality of the Aryan race hypothesis to dislocative nationalism. Again, down to this day, it's still a very, very lively form of identity politics in Iran.
Sure is, yeah. And you mentioned Mohammad Reza Shah, Pahlavi, the last Shah of Iran, the last king of Iran. And that's actually a great transition to, I think, the portion of this book that a lot of people are going to be particularly interested in, which is the sort of the instrumentalization of some of these ideas by the Iranian state over the course of the 20th century, by the Pahlavi state. You have these last two chapters of your book, The Road to Officialdom and Triumph, where you talk about the process of how this happens. Can you tell us a bit more about this, about how that process takes place, how dislocative nationalism becomes, in effect, kind of official Pahlavi ideology from the sort of 1920s to the 1970s?
Yes. So if we go back to 1900, all we have are the texts of Akhundzadeh and Kermani, and they have not really caught on by 1900. Modernism is still flavor of the day, and Iranians are bracing themselves, where they don't know it, but we know it in retrospect, for the constitutional revolution. The constitutional revolution is the culmination of modernist thought. It's the culmination of
this attempt. The constitutional revolution of 1906.
Exactly. It goes on for a few years. It brings about a constitution, a modern, you could claim a modern state, a modern parliament, etc. With ups and downs, with ebbs and flows. Unfortunately, for many reasons that it would be too, we should not get into here now and today, but the constitutional revolution largely fails again. And Iran, as a territorial state, almost implodes in the 20th century. So it is only when modernist ideas of state reform and constitutionalism are discredited in the minds of the intellectuals that, starting in the 1910s, you start to see dislocative ideas be expressed in the newspapers and pamphlets that appear. And when the Pahlavi state emerges, the way I see this, for those who are familiar with the theories of nationalism, you can see this passage from constitutionalism to the Pahlavi state as a transition from a civic form of nationalism to an ethnic form of nationalism. The civic form of nationalism being constitutionalism, an open nation. The closest examples would be Britain or the French Republic or the United States. Anyone can become a member of the national community for as long as you pay loyalty to the state and its institutions and its legislation. And I believe that constitutionalism held this promise. But then you have the ethnic form of nationalism, which is dislocative nationalism, the nationalism of the Pahlavis that emerges as a response to the failure of civic nationalism. So here it's a nationalism that is exemplified by Germany until recently and many East European countries, where the national group is closed. You are either an ethnic national or you aren't an ethnic national. In a long process of learning, the king, Reza Shah, becomes a convert to dislocative nationalism. And that's why dislocative nationalism becomes part of the official ideologies, obviously, because there wasn't only one, and you could hardly rule with dislocative nationalism alone. Part of the official ideologies of the modern nation state of Iran. And this explains the success and the stability of dislocative nationalism, because a modern state that could reach, you know, the farthest reaches of its territory, hammered this ideology into the brains, or drilled, this ideology into the brains of its population through mass schooling, a national curriculum, propaganda, and a repertoire of symbols. And you have a number of non-state actors, particularly intellectuals, such as, for instance, Hoveyda, who is our greatest novelist and author, I think, by far, but who promoted the ideas of dislocative nationalism. And you also have a number of what I call pseudo-historians, such as Zarin Kub, Abdul Karim Zarin Kub, with his famous 1957 book, Two Centuries of Silence, that further promoted these ideas into society. Do you want me to say more about the Pahlavi state, or?
We're probably running a little short on time, so we'll tempt readers with perhaps what they're missing here. The book ends on a slightly pessimistic note, right? You talk about the sort of the failure of dislocative nationalism. Can you tell us a bit more about
it? Beyond the personal stances, the personal position that I have against, you know, racial thought and forms of racial hatred, which make me reject dislocative nationalism, I simply believe that dislocative nationalism has failed to bring about the millennium as was promised by the people who have subscribed to it. The claim that is often made is that this is a very diverse and in some respects unstable land, and you needed something to hold it together. I do believe that this is a false claim. I do not believe that dislocative nationalism, with its centralizing and Persianizing instincts, has helped keep the country together. If anything, I believe large sections of the society have been very much alienated from the central state. I'm particularly referring to the peripheries of the Iranian nation, the ethnic peripheries, the religious, not the religious peripheries, but particularly the ethnic peripheries that have been alienated by the Pahlavi state and the dislocative nationalism. I doubt that this is what's going to keep Iran together in the future. What Iran, in my view, needs, but this is my humble view, and I do realize that it's probably very idealistic, I don't know of many people who think along the same lines, is a new sort of a novel sort of civic nationalism. You know, a civic nationalism to which any member, any inhabitant of the Iranian plateau can belong to, you know, regardless, irrespective of religion or ethnicity or language or status or gender, because this state and its institutions are legitimate and perceived as legitimate by majority of the population. The reason why I'm slightly pessimistic is that I do not see how the under present circumstances how this could come about. In my view, the Islamic Republic to a large extent has retrieved aspects of dislocative nationalism. The attitude of the state towards the ethnic minorities is testimony to the continuity from before 79 and to after 79.
And just so we're clear, in case people aren't sort of familiar with some of Iran's ethnic makeup, and we're talking about in particular sort of Arab minorities, Baluchis, Kurds, Armenians, etc., who would not fit into this
kind of framework. Yes, and we are not. Right? I mean, there is no data on minorities in Iran, which is of course a big problem for us researchers. But Persian speakers, the Persian speaker majority is, according to some scholars, in fact, a minority. It's anywhere between, it's about half the population, let's put that. It's put at anywhere between 45 and 55 to 60% of the population. The Azeris, that are the largest minority, and let us bear in mind that Akhundzadeh and many dislocative nationalists hailed from its ranks, represent anything between 25 and 35% of the population. So we are not talking about small minorities. We are talking about very sizable constituencies of the modern Iranian nation states.
And so I'm just curious, what the reaction has been from Iranians who have read your book. I'm thinking especially sort of Iranian exile community, Iranians in the diaspora. I imagine you probably get into some fairly heated conversations, because I'm picturing this, the argument you're making, as being actually very upsetting and traumatizing to people who have grown up very much believing everything that you're dismantling and taking apart. You have some great lines in the beginning in the introduction about, and it reminds me of just how many, anyone who's ever been to Iranian businesses, to travel agencies, to restaurants, to anything, the sheer number, and in Iran as well as abroad, businesses that are named, Aria or Persepolis or what have you, right? I mean, this is such a cherished part for a particular generation, I think, especially of Iranians. And I'm just curious, what the reception has been as you've talked about the book to some of these communities.
So within the scholarly community, I was very pleased to see that the book was well received. There was a sense that these ideas needed to be explained. And let us not forget that we are slightly behind. So, we like to think of ourselves as better than our neighbors, but Turks and Turkish nationalism and Arab nationalism have been extensively studied since the 60s and 70s, whereas we are just starting, so we're very, very behind. And so there was a sense that there was a gap that needed to be addressed. And I'm very pleased to say that most reviews, most, not all of them, have been positive. I hope that I deserve them. As far as the non-academic public is concerned, I do occasionally receive, of course, the odd email of insults. There are websites that I'm being disparaged. That was to be expected. As you say, upsetting, I'm sure, for some people who like to believe themselves as good as Germans, and now they realize that they are not Germans. But so be it. I don't see any reason why I should sugarcoat my ideas. Unfortunately, a lot of this is polemics. It's polemical, right? So, typically the sort of comments that I will get at the bottom of the pages where my name appears, not the scholarly articles, but sort of like the op-eds and the interviews, are polemical, and the attacks are ad hominem. It rarely goes beyond, Zia Brahimi is an agent of the Islamic Republic and a British spy all at the same time, which is quite fascinating. Yes. So, now it's going to be interesting to see the reaction of the readership in Iran itself. There is a official translation of the book that is in the pipeline, and a few interviews in journals and newspapers. So let's see where it goes. But clearly, dislocative nationalists are no friends of mine. There are always a couple at any talk I give. They always ask the same questions. They always come up with the same accusations, and so be it.
That's how you know you're doing something important. Well, Reza, we've taken up a lot of your time today. I really appreciate it. But so just one sort of final question. What are you working on next?
I'm working on something that most people would see as completely different, which is an entangled history of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia in modern Europe, not in Iran, with a particular emphasis on conspiracy theories. And whether conspiracy theories play a central role in anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, and I try to argue that yes, they do. So in a way, it's different because I'm not working on Iran at the moment, but there is clearly a link. In fact, my interest in the subject my interest started when I was researching the European Orientalist template of dislocative nationalism, when I was reading large chunks of text from Gobineau or Ernest Renan, etc. So I'm going back to the same templates. I'm going back to the same sources, but to study them for a completely different purpose. Once this project has been finalized, hopefully in a few years, and it will come out hopefully in book form, I hope to go back, if you will, to Iran and perhaps look into anti-Semitism in Iran, which is a topic that I would like to look into more closely.
Well, it sounds fascinating. I know a lot of people will be looking forward to all of that work. Great. Well, thank you very, very much for being with us. Again, I've been talking today to Reza Zia Ebrahimi. He's the author of a new book, a fascinating new book, The Emergence of Iranian Nationalism, Race and the Politics of Dislocation, published by Columbia University Press. Reza Zia Ebrahimi, thank you very much for joining us on the program today.
Thank you very much, John.